Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2005. This session, Muslim-Christian Dialogue, Why, How, and With Whom? Presented by Nellie Van Doorn Harder, in the Fireside Room, disc number VAN-2005-07. Let's listen in.
And as we call this Muslim-Lutheran Dialogue, an unfocused focus. Maybe I should introduce myself first, because maybe not everybody was here last time. Who was not here this week yet? Who is new? Okay, then I must introduce myself. Well, you know me. I know. Okay. My name is Nellie Van Doorn Harder, and I teach Islam and World Religions at Valparaiso University, which is 50 minutes away from the center of Chicago when you drive fast. Otherwise, you make it to High Farm in 50 minutes. And I am originally from the Netherlands, never, of course, planned to leave ever, because the Netherlands was quite nice. But then I met my American husband, and hence I came here. I have been a missionary for 10 years in total. 4.5 years I was in Egypt, where I set up a refugee agency, and 5.5 years my husband and family and me were in Indonesia, and we were teaching in a seminary, for those of you who were not here before. So, coming back to the middle, I consider us as people in the middle of the Christian spectrum. We are not extremely conservative, and we are not extremely liberal, are we? But how do we know that we are not extremely conservative? What makes us less conservative than extremely right? I never know how to call them really far right Christians. What would the difference be between yourself and far right Christians, you think?
I think it would be
belief.
How yeah? strongly you believe one way or the other.
How strongly you believe one way or the other. But also think about those of other faiths. We're talking about Muslims today. What would your attitude be about Islam?
How rigid you are.
What?
How flexible or how rigid you are.
Right. How flexible or rigid you are. We all heard some leaders of the very far right say hurtful things about Islam on radio and so forth. And some people don't think that dialogue is necessary at all, because they feel that Muslims should simply be converted, right?
You asked what
we are.
Gray.
We're neither white. We're gray, right. That's what I say. We're kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
We accept we are Christians, and we stand for our Christianity, or we are on the way, and we stand for being on the way. But that doesn't mean that we condemn others for their faith, or at least even if we think it's wrong, we don't go on national radio and say that they are going to burn in hell. But basically, who knows here who's going to burn in hell? I don't. I don't know who's going to burn in hell eventually. So I think that's a little bit the gray people, right? So that is why we are open to Muslim-Christian dialogue or relationships with Muslims, and that is why I call it the Lutheran dialogue, because many of us are Lutherans, not all, but also of us who are Presbyterians, for example, our churches are very active. And I don't know how many of us realize that both the Presbyterian and the Lutheran Church have been active in interfaith dialogue since, well, I can say 50 years. Who of us realizes that? Who of us knows that? You know that? And do you know how it started?
No.
No? Maybe Professor Feta knows from... Yeah, it started in Palestine. It started in Palestine. And that brings us to the next topic, while it is very important to have that conversation, because in Palestine, the Lutheran Church has a sister church. We know about that, right? We have a Palestinian Lutheran Church. And so, just for them, they live in an ocean of Muslims. Just for them to have feedback and to have a sounding board of what to do and how to connect with those Muslims, it was important that we were engaged in that topic. And there are other Lutheran churches in the world that live in an ocean of Muslims. Can we think of any? Indonesia. The Indonesian Bataks, they live in a country that has 90% Muslim, 92% Muslims. Any others that we can think about?
Syria. Christians and Jews.
Right. There are Christian communities in many Muslim countries. And if you think specifically Lutheran, then we say Indonesia. Also Nigeria. Nigeria has quite significant Lutheran community. So that is how it started in many ways. Questions from the churches in those countries to the headquarters here and those were different headquarters then, right, than what we have now, but here in the States. So can you help us? Can you help us study more about Islam? Can you help us find ways to have conversations with Muslims and so forth? But now, if we think back about those of you who are here, if we think back about what we have heard about Islam, what would you say would be difficult for us? What would be really like almost obstacles for us if we think about we are facing a Muslim who's very devout and who knows his or her stuff? That is also important, right? Who knows their stuff, a person who knows their stuff. Because we were just talking with dinner, right, that not every Muslim knows Islam. You know, they maybe do the five pillars and they have learned to pray and they've learned a few verses from the Quran, and I've repeated that over and over again this week, that not every Muslim knows their own heritage very well and is very well educated, and like most Christians, you know, we just know a little bit of what we hear in church and so forth, but a lot of Christians do not study Christianity deeply. I guess the people in Holden here are different. I'm feeling that all of you are extremely well aware of things and discussions. This is a different crowd, but you know, go out in the world and you'll find out what I mean. But so, thinking about this past past talks that we had this Monday and Tuesday, what would you say would be difficult to understand or to relate to?
Repeat the question.
What do you think, if you talk to Muslims, thinking back about what we talked about Monday and Tuesday, what do you think would be really difficult to understand or to overcome or to relate to when you talk to Muslims as a Christian?
Well, I believe in a Trinitarian God.
The Trinity, definitely.
The status of women.
Status of women. Shall we write those down? Trinity, women, remember the hot button topics, especially the women, is much more hot button really than the Trinity, because nobody was here last week when I gave a talk on the Trinity. Most Muslims don't care a bit about the Trinity. And you know the Trinity in the Quran, right? Didn't I tell you? You know it, so tell us, what is the Trinity in the Quran?
I don't remember.
Oh, okay. It's, you know, think this way. Syria, Jordan, 100% Christian, but what kinds of Christians at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, 7th century? Orthodox. People knew nothing. Yeah, they were Orthodox, but they knew nothing about nothing. They were illiterate, right? They probably went to the mass, they listened to their priest mumble, they knew a little bit about the Bible. And it was still the time that people were getting a headache about thinking of what is this Trinity. Okay, the big councils had passed and it was settled. I see Professor Fred thinking when, you know, the big councils had been, it was decided what the Trinity was, Father, Son and Holy Spirit. But it was a difficult topic for people to grasp. Don't you think it's a difficult topic? Who thinks the Trinity is just all set and easy? I still think it's difficult. When I try to wrap my mind around it, right? And the church leaders were giving all kinds of ideas, like think about the sun, and that there's the sun, and then the warmth of the sun, and then are the rays of the sun, but it's still all one sun. Well, you remember now?
I remember now.
Okay, well.
God, Father, Mary, and Jesus.
Right, so, for these, you know, Christians in the Middle East, Father, Son, and of course, there needs to be a wife in there, right? Mary, that was it. And that was often how they pictured the Trinity. And that is what the Prophet Muhammad must have heard as he made his trips as a salesperson, or he was a merchant before he became a full-time prophet. You know, he was a merchant, and he made trips to Syria and Jordan and so forth. So you see, that is what came in the Quran. And so if you talk to Muslims, they either don't know that that's in the Quran, or they know it is father, mother, and son, or they don't care. They don't care. The Trinity to them is something like, well, it shows that Christians are wrong, but we knew Christians were wrong. So why bother to think deeply about what they actually believe? So it's the Trinity. It's a very big... So do you think it is useful, and I'll come back to that question, I'll just throw it out now, you think about it, and then we'll come back to it. Do you think it is useful to have large conferences with Muslims on one side and Christians on one side and talk about the Trinity? No. Or does anybody have an answer right up front? What do you think? You said
no.
No, it won't change anybody's mind. We believe in the Trinity, whether we can wrap our minds around it or not. We say there is a mystery. God has mysteries. It's fine, and we can try to explain it in all kinds of ways. And the Church Fathers did explain it, right? And we have the creed and so forth. And the Muslims will always say you are polytheists, right? Because even if we say it's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in their mind they will say, ha-ha, see, they're changing the text again. It's not in the Quran. In the Quran, it's Father, Son, St. Mary. You see the problem. Okay, now, let's go back to the women. And before we go to the women, let's ask, are there more things that you would see as difficult, as hard to discuss, yeah?
Something that you actually told me, that if I visited a mosque, they would want to try to convert me.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Very strong mission urge. Yeah, very strong mission urge. Especially the young people. We've talked yesterday, we talked about the young people. Remember, we wanted shortcuts to heaven, and if you don't want a shortcut to heaven, a suicide bomber, you want it by having the truth. They will hit you with that truth. They will, and I gave the example, right, in Valparaiso University, we had a commemoration ceremony for 9/11, 1 year after it happened, and we had a Jewish, Christian, and Muslim. We had Jewish, Christian, Muslim representatives, and we had prayers and things like that, and you know, just commemoration. And I came out, and I ran into the then Imam of Michigan City. I know some of you are from Michigan City. No, are they here? There was a couple from Michigan City just now, but maybe you're not here. No, and he kept me for 2 hours. Trying to convert me, you know, and I told him several times, look, no, it has not, no Egyptian, no Indonesian has managed to convert me. Once a whole stadium prayed for my conversion, I am still too stubborn. Give it up. He didn't. You know, it was like a personal victory. If I can draw her in, I said, no, you can't. Finished. I have thought about this very deeply, you know, otherwise I wouldn't be in this business. Okay. So conversion, yeah.
How about separation of church and state? Is that
politics? Shall we call it politics? Sure. Yeah, it's a big hot word, right? Politics, right? Politics. Okay. Now, let me now first disappoint you terribly with one statement that you might not a fact that you might not be aware of. Many missionaries have tried to convert Muslims, and we used to have the monopoly, you know, when, for example, Egypt, well, most of the Middle East was occupied, colonized by the British, the French, and so forth. Indonesia was colonized by the Dutch. Many people went out as missionaries. Churches were planted, local churches were planted. However, the conversion of Muslims to Christianity, you can count on a hand, on the fingers of one hand. Almost no Muslims ever converted, even if they were just nominal Muslims. Because it is hammered into you that you go to hell if you do convert to anything else. That is hammered into you. That is what you grow up with. I talk to my Muslim friends, and they will tell how their mother, as they are 4, 5, 6 years old, describes in vivid pictures how you will burn, how your fingers will be chopped off, how you will be hung up on your nose, and so forth, and so forth. Think about that, what it does to the mind of a 4, 5, 6-year-old, if you convert. So you see, you are literally raised with the terror of hell. And so that is one thing you have to keep in mind, that Muslims nowadays, you know, even having interfaith dialogue with others, to them that is a huge step in many ways, because they feel, oh my gosh, I am exposing myself to danger. A lot of Muslims, especially Muslims who are not used to interacting with Christians or who are not used to interacting with practicing Christians, because a lot of Muslims are used to interacting with secular people, right? But, oh, you were the ones from Mission City. That's there you are. Okay. I thought we were out there. I saw them. Okay. Anyway, so that just exposing yourself to someone who's not Muslim and might influence you is seen as very, very dangerous. Can you understand that? Can you follow? Can you kind of imagine that? And would you have that feeling? Would any of us have that feeling? So, well, if I go and I expose myself to Muslims, I might have the same feeling.
Is it much different than the indoctrination that you get if you grow up in the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church?
I know. I grew up in a church. I grew up in the far right wing of the Dutch Calvinist Church, where I heard twice a day, 45 minutes or 90 minutes every Sunday, that I was going to hell. So, I don't know. Maybe. It's a double predestination. Most of us were not going to be saved. So, this room, maybe one, if we're lucky. I don't know. But maybe, I don't know. Because I didn't grow up Missouri Synod. That is, you know.
If a Muslim man marries a Christian woman, does she have to convert?
No, but the children are automatically Muslim. That's it. And we will focus on those children. What?
Catholic Church, I have to.
Yeah.
I get it by choice. I don't
require it. But according to the law. Because, okay, so we have missionary, we have politics. Anything else we want to say about this? Anything else?
Culture.
Oh, man, culture. Yeah. That's such a big problem, such a big issue. We are coming from very different cultures, but that is changing too, right? Mm-hmm. Because we heard this week that. Muslims are coming here, TV, internet, you know, the exchange of culture is becoming more and more influential, right? But culture remains, you know, if you have interfaith marriages, and especially when someone marries someone from a little bit of a remote culture, like an American marries an Egyptian who's never really left Egypt, you can be in trouble. Yeah. Anything else that we say? Yeah?
What about the ethnicity? The Shiite and the Sunni?
Well, that is not so much our problem. That is more between them. You see, when we talk with Muslims, we do not really discern Shiite Sunnites.
But don't we sort of have sympathy towards one branch rather than another?
Maybe, I don't know, who has sympathy towards Sunnites? Who has sympathy towards Shiites?
I guess we don't care.
Yeah. I don't know.
What are the Kurds?
They're Muslims, Christians. They're Christian Kurds, yeah. Sunnite Kurds, Shiite Kurds, what?
They pray five times a day.
Who?
Muslims?
All Muslims, yeah. Shiite, Sunnite, everybody should pray. Don't pray. Should pray five times a day. Doesn't mean they do it. Okay? Okay. So, okay, but we take this package. We talked about the Trinity a little bit. And let us first put this package here. And then first place it in what we also have been seeing this whole week. Remember we talked about the individualization of society, that the individual has become more and more important also in Islamic societies, and that has led to a terrible crisis, a crisis of authority, remember? And that we then see that people sometimes, you know, fly to the far right where there is security and truth because they can't handle something else. And so if we talk about Muslims and we look at all these topics, we also have to know that within Islam there's a large range of opinions, right? From very progressive, moderate, to extremely conservative, or basically intolerant, yeah? We know that. And we also know that within Muslim society, these different streams are battling each other. And that you know, you cannot just say Islam or a Muslim. It depends very much whom you talk to and where that person comes from and what that person is involved in at one point. Now, women, why did I leave this for a minute? Because that really brings you in the law. That brings you in the position of women is mostly regulated in the Islamic law part, the Sharia part, that is called the personal status law. And so when you deal about the issue with women, you have the issue of law, very much like Orthodox Jews have. And then talking about the difference within Islam, among Muslims, you know that when you have Reformed Jews, they are no longer considered Jews by Orthodox Jews. You know that, right? Orthodox Jews see Reformed Jews as nothing. Well, the same is the case in Islam. A very strict Muslim or a very conservative Muslim will consider a progressive or a modern Muslim as no longer a Muslim. And in some cases that goes that far that people had to leave the country. They had to flee the country because they were accused of being apostates. They were accused of falling away from their faith. So you have to keep that in mind as well. So we have this issue of the law, and if we come back to the system that you go back to in Islam, where the Quran is the holy word, the tradition of the Prophet is the next best holy word, and from there you have the interpretation of the both, and from there you have the law. You have the Islamic law, and then you have the jurisprudence. If you think about that, remember, then you have that holy package, that package that is seen as so holy that you cannot, as human beings, change it just like that. And so that is also something you have to keep in mind. Certain topics are very hard to discuss simply because there is a law under them that we don't have. You see, for us, the role of women is not regulated by Christian law, or is it? No, it is voluntary. It is voluntary. When we marry in a church, and then we follow voluntarily the rules of that church. And if we don't like them any longer, we break them. Right? Mm-hmm. But we will not be caught by the police and brought home. Which can happen to you in a Muslim country. In Egypt, when you, as a wife, says, I'm running away, you remember? You can be taken home by the police by force. And because we also learned that the marriage contract, if you talk about marriage, is actually a buying contract, a contract of buying and selling, right? And so that is something that you run into. So the Trinity has to do with polytheism, in the sense that, and with changing the scriptures. You know, the idea that we change the scriptures and that Islam came to correct the scriptures. Then you have the Islamic law that cannot be changed according to traditional or more conservative Muslims. And from there, you have the missionary. You have the missionary, because if you feel that you have the holy law and that you have the right scriptures, then you want everybody to follow that. So just you have to assume people want you to be saved. If they want you to be Muslim, they want you to be saved. And I've often had that in a little village, for example, a child would come up to me and call me a kafir, which is an unbeliever. And I would ask her, why am I an unbeliever? She said, well, I don't know, you're an unbeliever. What does it mean? I have no idea. But, you know, they just heard it from their parents. And then I told them that I'm a Christian. Aren't you supposed to accept Christians? And, no, you'll go to hell. Okay, and then we would talk for a while, and then you would end up, invariably it would end up like, I'll pray that you become a Muslim so that we can be in heaven together. You see, so there's also a goodness, there's a desire that you might be in the right place. If, you know, so it's not just only negative, you know, but it becomes negative when you talk about politics, because that is power. That is sheer power. Right? And so, by the way, I'll hand this around, and then when it arrives at you, John, you can keep it. Okay. This book, if you ever want to have a little bit of background on Islam and the Quran, this is a very nicely written book. And I'll tell you a little bit more about it later. But he also writes that nowhere in the Quran it says that the ruler has to be Muslim. That is a rule that came later. That is a rule from the tradition following the Prophet. But nowhere in the Quran it says you must have an Islamic government. That was a construction, you see. And now, if we look now, we fast forward to the 21st century, and what do we see in all these Muslim countries? That the far-right Muslims, the extremist Muslims, accuse their governments of being unbelievers. Even in Saudi Arabia, they're being accused of being unbelievers, right? By even more extremist Muslims. And so, in the end, it is a quest for power. It has become a blunt quest for power nowadays, right? But it goes back, but again, it goes back to the time that the empire was won and there was one caliph, and we know that only took a while, although maybe 100 years, that was it, and then everything, you know, fell apart, or you get these sub-caliphs, because you cannot rule a huge empire just by yourself. Like, we have governors too. But the thing is this, that if we meet with Muslims here in the States, this is a big issue for them. A lot of Muslims wonder if they should be in a country that is not ruled by Muslims. They wonder if, for example, I have heard discussions, why shouldn't we, like the Mormons, buy a state? And I heard I happen to know that you're from North Dakota. I have heard that mentioned. I don't know if you like that idea, but like, which state is empty enough? Like, you see? Because then at least you can have your own governor. You see? Because imagine living now in California, being Muslim, huh? Think about it. So that is absolutely your worst nightmare. To have to, it would be my worst nightmare too. But that's because I'm from the Netherlands and we are a little bit suspicious of Arnold Schwarzenegger. I know. We wonder why he left. Don't you ever wonder why I had to leave in such a hurry? Anyway. So, but you see, if you talk, you know, you say you've dialogue, but this political issue is huge. And the culture, don't we all have instances where we talk with someone and we were thinking we talked about one thing and then we realize this person is talking about something very different? Any of us as an example? Nobody?
Happens all the time,
right? And so imagine if you're from another culture. You have no idea. First of all, you can make mistakes in language. My favorite is Paul is not here, right? My husband. Our favorite mistake is when he said in Indonesian, he said, we will berdosa, instead of berdoa. Instead of let us pray, he said, let us sin together. So that's your first point of departure, just the language. And then your frame of reference, right, is so different. I mean, whenever, even if you come from a different state, your frame of reference is different. And so that is a huge, it's not an obstacle, but it is exciting. You know, all these points I'm writing down here, we should see them as exciting. How can we talk about them? But the issue is this, how do we talk about it? We have all these issues, and how do we talk about them? You know, in the old days, and I don't want to insult anybody in this room, but older gray men used to sit together with other older gray men, one side Muslim, one side Christian, and they would discuss, right? And of course, that was not in vain. There were lots of products coming out of that, writings, publications, and slowly, for example, at Luther Seminary, we had Roland Miller, who set up a whole project in Muslim studies, and we now have future pastors doing extra studies on Islam, or we have people taking an MA in Islamic studies. So it is not in vain, but it somehow stayed in a very, very, academic, what did you
exclusive.
Say?
Exclusive.
Esoteric,
elite.
Maybe.
Huh? Esoteric. It could be very esoteric at times, yes. It's, you know, it stayed in an upper class. It didn't reach you, did it? It didn't reach you, and it didn't reach me either because I'm a woman. You see, there was really no space for others. Very few women were involved in that because, you know, the scholars from Islam were mostly men. So in order to have a balance, it were men who were invited. And so that is something that is changing. So because if you have these topics, right, and you just talk politely, you don't really come very far. What you do is you learn from each other, you learn about each other, and that's important, but it stays at a certain level. And what we are at now, you know, we are at a time in the Muslim world where we are very near to what I call a reformation. Great changes are going to come. They might not be there in our lifetime, but there are going to be changes. There is no way back. Once you have that satellite dish on your roof, there is no way back, right? Unless you put them all in Holden for 5 years or something like that. I don't know. There's no way back for us too. There's no way back for us. Once you learn something, you cannot unlearn it, right? You know it, and you think, and you develop. That's the same in the Muslim world, but that is what we're saying. But we have changed too. And I don't know if you are realizing that we are on the brink of a revolution concerning interreligious dialogue. Who of you realizes that? You do? Okay, how so?
Just within our church, we've been having more and more discussions about inviting more Muslims to talk about the religion, to learn more about the religion.
Right.
10 years ago, we didn't do that.
You invite Muslims now, they come to your church. Mm-hmm. The fact that the Muslim comes to a church at all is huge. You know, because a lot of Muslims would never want to set foot in a church. Like if you go to the Middle East, Christians don't want to set foot in a mosque. They feel that they pollute themselves if they do that. Why do you think it is changing?
Well, I think there's a lot of exchange of people around the world. We travel, we go to Muslim countries.
Right.
You know, I went to Western Turkey, which was the first Muslim country I'd gone to, and I expected to find people with scimitars and it would be dangerous to walk the streets. And, mm-hmm. You know, and I didn't find that at all. I found a very friendly, warm people. I had no problems, no religious problems with them. I found they were very much like people in this country, and I visited little villages, and we
right.
get together and drink apple tea at 5 o'clock, and I was the first Westerner they'd seen, and they would go out and get fruit on their bicycles and bring it back and give it to me. They were enormously friendly people. Everybody
right.
wanted to give me apple tea. Apple tea, yeah.
Okay.
Very popular. So I found
right.
them to be really delightful people, and
yeah.
I, you know, they weren't out to kill me, and I was not to kill them. And, we just became good friends with many people.
Well, that is wonderful. Thank you so much. Because
we also, of course, had in Portland. We had in Portland, Oregon. We have several mosques.
Yeah.
And they used to. They're not now because of some of the problems that went on in Portland with the government and arresting Mayfield, mm-hmm. Brendan Mayfield, and the problems he had. But the several of the mosques, most of the members of whom work for Intel and mm-hmm. such. They opened their doors to Christians and had open houses and welcomed Christians in and served us food and things. So we, those of us who went, discovered, well, these are really rather nice people. They're not the people we thought they were.
Right.
They're much similar to ourselves than we had thought. And so there's interactions like that, I think, that are new.
What you are expressing is that we are slowly discovering that instead of texts, we also have shared humanity.
Right.
Right? It is that what is changing. It is changing what is happening. As I say, what is the, as you say, the world is becoming more global. And we see that we're all people and that we have a globe to take care of. Right? And it is this shared humanity where we are trying to find new ways of interacting. And in many ways, what we are learning is that, for example, peace studies is very influential here. Peace studies, because from peace studies we taught, and I'll give you very quickly the wrap here. From peace studies we learned that you can come together, right? And you talk about women, and then you have these very different perceptions. One thing's in law, and this is what women should, they should not, and this is how I should be towards the women, blah, 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 right? And then you have this other Western American from Oregon or wherever who has none of that kind of reference, frame of reference. So what you should do is you should create new spaces. Create new spaces where you can find things to share. Well, and there are thousands. Can we think of things that we can share to talk about?
Food.
What?
Food.
Oh, first one, absolutely. Food, eating together, drinking apple tea, very important. What else?
Family.
Family, absolutely. That's what people forget over and over again. We all have kids. We love our kids. Whatever we are, wherever we are, we want our kids to, you know, to grow up well and be educated. And here and there are some exceptions, but most Muslim women do not want a suicide bomber. And, you know, they don't want their son to become a suicide bomber. That is very few. I know from Palestine that there are some cases where they're very proud when the son does this. But most cases, they are not very proud, and they really do not want their child to go there. First of all, it's unproductive. You don't get grandchildren. Those of us who have grandchildren, isn't that a delight you never want to miss? Right. So you see, we look a lot like each other. We look a lot like each other. And so if you think, you know, if you think about all the layers, I saw your hand. If you think about all the layers that we have in society, we have political leaders talking together, right, and making peace or not peace. We have governments talking together. We have all kinds of high layers talking together. But what we learn from peace studies is that when things come up from the grassroots, it's much more powerful and much more real. Then it is more real. And then it can last. So if you look in different countries where they do have interface interactions, for example, orchestrated by the government, the result is very different than when it comes from the people. And I saw that in Indonesia. The government in Indonesia did not want to have a second Iran. So it forbade all extremists, and also Shiites are forbidden to enter Indonesia officially. And what it did in schools, there was the topic of inter-religious dialogue, which was really the most boring of all the classes. Because the people teaching that didn't really know what they were talking about. You had a Muslim talking about interreligious dialogue from a book, but it wasn't real. And so what you then had was a reaction of grassroots organizations, non-governmental organizations, who said, we have to start real dialogue. And they would call together religious leaders, teachers of religion in the school, and they would go through all the hard topics. And you know what the hard topics were? And then I let you talk. What were the hard topics, you think? What were the first topics they talked about? The Trinity?
No.
Women?
Politics.
Huh? Mission?
Separation of church and state?
No.
Economics?
Right! They talked about the large Indonesian debt. That was one of the first topics they talked about. And they went on for a whole year. And they realized, our debt's coming out of our ears, and we're both Muslims, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists. We need to do something, you see? And then they started all kinds of projects, and that was what ended in the fall of Suharto. Because then they found out how that debt had actually come into existence, and they found out what happened with the money that had come into the country. So the repercussions of those meetings were enormous, you see? And they said, we have to take control. We have to make this real rather than everything orchestrated by the government. So you see, you also have to look at from where it comes. And that's why do I say this to you? Because all of us are church members or not, but we're members of something else, right? We are members somewhere. And we can be very powerful in our own small environment. We can be very powerful even if we know only two Muslims. And we make a good relationship with them, and they go back to wherever they come from, and they talk about us there. That, in the end, will have way more effect then when, I'm sorry to say, I hate to say this, but our government, you know, makes videos about the states that are sent to the Middle East and to the Muslim countries. You know about that? Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen Indonesians watch the video. They fall from their chair laughing. I think it is so silly, because everybody knows the agenda, knows it is not really real. What is much realer is when you do something. Okay, you first, and then I saw a hand there. Yeah?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I'm not discounting that we have very different frames of reference, but really, when you talk about the things that are important to the Muslims, there are also things that are very important to extremely right-wing Christians. Mm-hmm. So that, in reality, if you take a moderate Christian and a moderate Muslim, they probably have more in common than people who are extreme in either religion.
Right. Well, thanks for bringing that up.
And
so
I
important.
Think that that the frightening thing now is that we have, you know, kind of a show-off in power between the people who are extreme, whereas most of the world is
not.
Is finding more of the peace status and humanitarian exchange.
Thank you so much for underscoring that, because again, that's why the middle is so important. We are not gray, we are shining brilliantly. Whatever color are we? Shall we be blue? because you are so right. The majority of this world is pretty moderate. Because being extremist is extremely tiring. Don't you think so?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, some extremists become, you know, if you really want to stand for your religion, you can become a monk or a nun or become a mystical sheikh in Islam. How many people pull that off? Right? How many people do that, stand for that? Most of us get lazy. That's why I always say, after 40, no more suicide bombers. They all have to be younger too. Have to have the energy. And no, but most of us are pretty moderate. But you were in Turkey. No, I have seldom seen a country that is completely aggressively extremist. My most moderate and most progressive thinking and most intelligent student in Valparaiso University was a Saudi student. And he was so frustrated about his own country. And we talked often if he could go back. We often talked about that. What are you going to do with your life? And can I air these opinions? And then he would say, but you know, actually, when I air them in the right way, there are lots of people who agree with me. You see? But it is, we don't know how to express things. We don't know how to say them. We don't know where to place them. Again, you come back to a space, having the right space. It's very important. You know, whether you make that space with serving food or having a special environment or just doing something together, space is very important. You want to say something?
My cousins are from Palestine.
Yeah.
So we usually get together and stuff. And a lot of the times we're talking and they say, for example, you know, most people love Americans. It's the government and the policies of the government. Mm. And so that's one of the bigger issues there, because, you know, we get together as a family, we do birthdays, we do all sorts of...
Right.
But yeah, it's that, you know, when the government does certain things, they're frustrated because they don't understand why we're not... Why is your government doing this?
Right. That's a big topic. Yeah, but it's true that a lot of people, what you point at is that a lot of people do discern that there is a difference between people and their government, between the official and the non-official. And you also mentioned the birthdays and the celebrating together and the, you know, the feasting together. That is very important. Let me ask you, does any of you have any ideas or experience of what works in meeting with Muslims, or maybe you haven't met with Muslims but with other people of other faiths, yeah?
I'll share an experience. It's a matter of doing things together. I had opportunity in Columbia, South Carolina to supervise the construction of a Habitat for Humanity house that was built by a multicultural group, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim. And it was fascinating to see how the concern for the work drew people together as humans little concern about the religious kind of thing. One humorous thing, the morning we started, I remember a Muslim lady came, not with a burqa, but a long dress, and the floor system was done on the house, and she struggled up on there, put her hands on her hip and said, "Well, tell me what you want me to do." And I handed her a nail apron, and I said, "Well, let's start by putting the nail apron on, and I'll get you a hammer." And she did so without any hesitation. We shared on a daily basis in devotional kinds of things, asking people from those different faiths to offer the devotional thing. There was one woman who was very creative in connecting us in our variety with the task of building the house, and she went through the foundation and the structure and the innards and talked about how all these things needed to work together in the house, and saw that they had done among us. So, you know, that kind of an opportunity on a, I don't know what, community basis. It may not be a habitat house, but there are other things where the Muslim people are just as concerned about community well-being, structure, safety, economic possibility. And so I'm of the mind, I don't know whether you would agree, Nellie, that looking for those things to do things together are more productive than organizing something to talk together.
Right. That is the space. In the space you can do a lot. For example, learning together, students studying together. Many of you must have students, if you are in college, in the class, that are from other countries, or if you're teaching, or whatever situation you're in. Doing things together, studying together, working on some, being activists for something together. That is very powerful. And as I say, that is the new awareness. Doesn't mean that we have to delete studying. We still have to study. But for example, the Lutheran Seminary in Chicago right now has several Turkish students who are imams in Turkey. And they are doing an MA in Christian theology. So that will be very powerful when they go back. They go back and know more about Christianity. So I don't want to say that studying alone is not good. We need to do that. I mean, without study, I wouldn't know what I know. But, you know, it is. But the point is that it is very powerful what you can do in your own situation. You should never think this is useless. You see? Now, I have a question. You mentioned the praying, because that was one of my questions for the group. How far do you want to go? How far do you want to go if you meet with Muslims? You are from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Would you pray with Muslims?
Yes, I have.
You have? You have prayed with Muslims?
Yes. What was the intention of converting them?
It was with them. Okay, next question. Did you succeed?
No.
Okay. One nota bene, I forgot to tell you that who converted, like in the Middle East, who converted to Protestantism and Catholicism were the Orthodox Christians. So they took people away, the missionaries took people away from the local churches. And then in other countries, who converted were mostly people who were still tribal or indigenous, like in Nigeria.
Right.
It is not the Muslims, but the tribal religions. Yeah, okay, so, but this can happen. I'm not saying it's wrong. You know, if that is your conviction, because the thing is, we still have our own conviction. And I feel there is not one model. We are who we are. We have our beliefs. And we have to stand up for our beliefs. Don't you think so? Our beliefs are important to us. And they shape our identity. They shape who we are. We do not have to shed them because we happen to talk with someone of another faith. That is the biggest mistake made by lots of people. Do you recognize people who say, "Well, maybe I believe, maybe not"? If you can say that if you really do that. But a lot of people when they are Christian and they are confronted with someone who has this massive, you know, this massive model of this is my belief and what is your belief, then they start to waffle. Do you know what I mean? Or is it just in Europe that that happens? I've seen it so often. And that is, that shows, for a Muslim cannot place that. They cannot place that. They think, do you believe or not? Right? So being strong in your own convictions is very important. Yeah?
When you asked about praying together, we have a Turkish Muslim son-in-law, and it was trying to figure out what is the prayer, not would we have one, but what prayer could we all say together? And very simple, God is great. Mm-hmm. We can all say that together.
Right.
And so that's where we are at this point.
Yeah. You can find ways to pray together. You can do, for example, in Indonesia they say now we all pray according to our own tradition. And then you do either out loud one by one, or you pray silently, or you say no, we don't want to pray together. Or you say we make a prayer together. That is the prayer that we say together, but it is not from either tradition. There's many ways you can do this, but my point is, don't feel you must do something. Do what you feel fits you and fits your circumstances. And in many ways, you know where I learned that? From the mothers and fathers of the 3rd and 4th century desert. That's where I learned that, because they also lived in a world that was mostly not Christian. And they had to come to terms with their world, right? And they had to interact with their world. And many of them had fathers and mothers who had not been Christian. And so they would say, I pray for this person. I see this person as a creature created by God, and I see this person as someone Jesus came to save, but I pray according to what I pray, because I cannot pray according to the Roman emperor's prayers. I cannot do that. You see, so in many ways, we are not the first facing this issue. This has been an issue that people have faced since hundreds of years. It just suddenly was dropped on our doorstep on 9/11. Before that, we didn't really think about it, did we? But 9/11, suddenly, we became aware that there were non-Christians here, or Muslims, and we became aware of what is happening in this world and where this is going. Let's stop first for a minute. Any questions? Any remarks? Yeah?
Well, I just have a comment. Last year at Holden Village, about this time, there was a couple who gave a series of lectures for either 1 or 2 weeks, and he was a... Oh, year before last? He was a Lutheran minister, and she was a Muslim woman from Thailand who had been the minister of education or something fairly far up in the Thai government. And they gave a whole series of presentations on Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, and how we have common roots and how we, you know, separated things. But they gave a Vespers one night, I think it was at Vespers, and they talked about the problems that they have as this religiously mixed couple. And they said about the only big problem they have is that they pray differently. Mm-hmm. She gets down and on her knees and bows towards Mecca. He says he can't do that. Mm-hmm. It just makes him ill to do that. And and she doesn't pray like he does. It makes her feel badly. So they discussed this, but it wasn't enough to destroy their love or their living together. Mm-hmm. They just accepted it as a difference in how they each worship.
Right.
And
That's Harold and Mai Vogelaar. Harold and Mai Vogelaar. That's the name.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, he teaches at LSTC.
Oh.
The Lutheran School of Theology. Yeah, no, but this is very powerful, and they have been working on this topic very often, especially the interfaith marriage is a huge issue.
Right.
It's a huge issue where all these issues come up, you know, and where you have a little battle, but within the household. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the battle in the household is there anyway, but then even more, then it's the battle about, like, the man wants the woman to convert, or the woman wants the man to convert, you know, or what do you do with the children, and things like that. And when you have an interfaith marriage, all these things activate that we, for us, can still stay if we want to. These things can all stay academic, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have to become reality unless we happen to live next to Muslims or work with Muslims or seek Muslims out or end up in a situation. Yeah?
One thing we have in common that can be very helpful in some contexts is the figure of Abraham, right. Sarah, Hagar, Ishmael. Those Abrahamic texts are deeply rooted in all three major religious traditions. And a book like Bruce Feiler's, Abraham, A Journey into the Heart of Three Faiths, a book like that can be very helpful for stimulating conversation about common roots.
We have a lot of common roots. We also, you can mention Jesus in that line. Jesus is in the Quran. Jesus is actually very powerfully in the Quran. He's above Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad in the Quran. We didn't talk about that here, right? None of you was here when I talked about that. According to the Quran, Jesus was born without a mother. That means God was his father. According to the Quran, Jesus did not die a natural death. He was taken up to heaven. The only thing that the Quran does not mention is the crucifixion, or it mentions it actually so unclear that a lot of Muslims have interpreted it as that it says someone else was crucified in his place. And then that is the problem then, that because, you know, in the Arab tradition, the Bedouin Arab tradition, a prophet had to be successful. Someone who's crucified is a loser. So in a way, Islam wants to make Jesus higher by not having him crucified. You see? But so we have a lot in common. We have a lot in common. But the problem is when the C-word of competition set in, as Islam spread, its largest competition was Christianity. So it had to fence itself off from those Christians. It had to make sure that it was clear who was a Muslim and who was not, you see? And that is where then the differences come in the sense that the almost engineered differences between Christianity and Islam, where all of a sudden Jesus became, you know, again someone who was less than the Prophet Muhammad. And then you get the traditions where the Prophet Muhammad goes to heaven to meet God, and Jesus is not in the highest heaven, but in the lowest. You see? That's tradition. That's just from the tradition. That's not in the Quran. So in many, we share so much, but that is what makes it so difficult. Because we are in direct competition. And this comes back to the mission urge. We are in direct competition about souls. Who gets the most souls? Because who gets the most souls gets the power. Right? Who makes the most converts? If Nigeria, which is now 50-50 Christian Muslim, if that becomes 100% Muslim, the Muslims have the power. Right?
Correct.
And the oil. Third oil producing country in the world. Yes. So you see, there is a lot at stake. But it is true. If we can have the space where we can talk about those shared figures, it's very important. And it is, so turning it around, what you're saying, it is important that we make Muslims aware of that. Because as you said yourself, your son-in-law hardly knows what Islam really teaches, mm-hmm. right? And so if we can make Muslims aware, like, look, we do have shared things, and we do appreciate the same prophets, and we go back into the same traditions. It's just that your laws were made in the Arabian desert, and ours were made in Rome. Right? And that by itself created a huge difference. So that is something too that we can break open. I saw another hand. Yeah?
Well, I don't want to be negative, but it seems to focus, maybe the end of this discussion a little bit. It's not really, it seems to me, the problem with moderates. We're really talking about people who are willing to find those spaces and willing to find the commonality are not the people who are involved in 9/11 and its aftermath. And it's the extremists on both sides, let's face it. Western powers, unnamed, and Eastern powers are both run, I mean, the decisions, we're captive to a relatively small minority of religious extremists on both sides we're fighting it out. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be pessimistic, but it seems to me all of this discussion really is not relevant to the way that these people go about making decisions and running the world, which they are doing.
You mean the extremists?
Yeah. Well, the extremists don't care about spaces. They know they're right.
No. What I find very helpful is the Coptic Church that has to come to terms with extremists, because they literally, regularly have bombs hauled into their churches, you know, hurled at their churches. They have, and people are killed. I mean, I've been in church services where half an hour before, all family was massacred. That happens in Egypt. Now, they say the ones who want to kill, you cannot talk with them. You gotta lock them up. There's no other way. Lock them up or execute them, because they are like brainwashed. You cannot change their minds. But it is actually the ones just under that category, the ones who are extremists of mindset, but are not willing to take refuge into violence. They are important to continue the conversation with, to actually invite, to keep inviting into your conversation, even if they don't want to come. Because they can change the minds of the ones above them and the others who are in a, you know, range of getting more and more moderate. So in a way, you should never give up on extreme minds that are not wanting to kill, so to speak. But you are right. Our problem is that the whole tone is set by bombs in London and by bombs in the underground of Spain. That is the tone that is being set today. And that is our problem. And it is a problem for the Muslims too. So we must break through that, you know? That's why I say you are all very powerful where you are. You must break through it in your own environment. And you might meet that extremist. You know, I have several friends who were very extremist. Farid Ishaq, whose book is going around, he was an extremist. He is trained in the same madrasa as Mullah Umar, the leader of the Taliban. But Farid one day woke up and thought, I'm still alive thanks to our Christian neighbor. Because he's from South Africa, and his father left the mom alone, I think with six kids, and there were days they had nothing to eat. And it was the Christian neighbor who always fed them. Mm-hmm. And one day he just became aware of that. Wow, she's Christian, she's not Muslim. And that started, that made him think. And then he became the undersecretary, the secretary for emancipation, appointed by Bishop Nelson Mandela. But before that, he was a hammerhead preacher in a mosque, you see? And then his life changed slowly. And then he was sent to Germany and he studied with Jesuits of all people. And then he went to the Netherlands where he studied at the Calvinist Free University. And he is now one of the most progressive, moderate leaders. And a lot of Muslims hate him, you see, because of the way, because he knows his stuff, he knows what he stands for, and he knows where he comes from. You see, so we should say, yes, the violent extremists, we cannot talk to them, but the ones under that, who are maybe semi-brainwashed, but not quite totally yet. Yeah. You don't have to agree with me at all.
No, I agree with you.
We are discussing.
You focused on the Muslim. Yeah. I was actually thinking both sides had this problem.
Yeah, right, both sides.
Yeah.
I think we almost have to go for chapel, right?
Yeah.
One more question and then we stop.
A very beginner's question. Maybe more of us here than want to admit have no idea of how even to begin to find a Muslim to mm-hmm. talk to. Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions for those of us who don't have any contact with them?
Sure.
You can't go out to a street
no,
and say...
No, you can't. Well, you don't have to force the matter. Maybe you can be assisting people who do know Muslims. Or maybe something happens in your community, or somehow there's a group in your community. What do you call it? Colleagues. You don't have to force it. That would not be natural. It has to come up naturally. And I think, I assume that you all sit here because you somehow want to have some kind of fins to swim with if the time comes. You know? Because I myself, I was born and raised, I had never seen someone outside the village, 1,000 people, till I was about 18. you know, they were all totally white, Dutch, speaking a certain dialect. That was my world. I had no ideas what a Muslim was. Never. And then I went to Cairo. Oh my God, was I prejudiced. I knew I could not convert them. I knew that much. The Dutch church had told me that. But oh, was I prejudiced. And I still am at many times. But then, you know, you get to know many people and you forget and then you have to think, is this a Muslim or a Christian? And they forget what you are. Lots of people think I'm a Muslim because I know three words of Arabic. You know, but you just forget because you start to relate on the human level. So you know, but I would never force it. It comes on your path. But you maybe can talk to people, or when you hear someone say a blanket statement, you know, that might be also a start. Because I hear terrible blanket statements about us too.
Yes.
I mean, I was on TV in Nigeria with an imam who said, in America, there's no freedom of religions. Muslims are not allowed to build mosques. I said, wait a minute. You are very wrong here. You see, he said it on TV in Nigeria. Well, there he is poisoning all population. And this is not true. The first rule we have is freedom of religion. So that there's lots of things you can do when it comes up. I hope. Okay, well, thank you very much. And see you later.
Would someone hand me my door?